San Luis responds to the news of accusations against Cesar Chavez and a Cocopa tribal project. I'm Victor Calderon. This is KAWC's Arizona Edition. The mayor of San Luis said the city is canceling events for the farm worker rights leader following disturbing allegations.
It's unbelievable, huh? We Mexican-Americans do not have a lot of heroes that we can look up to. I think he was an iconic figure, and everything was a lie.
And the Cocopa Indian tribe is restoring part of their land.
Learning about all the different plants, what we use them for, how to restore them.
Those stories, plus the fallout from a Yuma school that had to close to repair its cooling system, coming up on Arizona Edition.
Funding for Arizona Edition comes from listeners just like you. Your continued support allows us to bring you insightful conversations about issues and events impacting our community. Thanks to you, we are able to highlight the people and voices of Yuma and La Paz counties and encourage civil conversations around water, agriculture, healthcare, education, and much more. Please continue to tune in to Arizona Edition, and thank you for helping us keep our community informed.
For KAWC News in Yuma, I'm Victor Calderon. The mayor of San Luis, Arizona, said city officials have canceled upcoming events for the late farmworker civil rights leader Cesar Chavez. This follows a New York Times report that Chavez, who was born near Yuma and died in San Luis, abused and raped women and girls. NPR reports Chavez, the famed union leader, has been accused of sexually abusing two girls in the 1970s, as well as Dolores Huerta, with whom he co-founded the United Farm Workers in the 1960s. That's according to an investigation published by The Times. San Luis has held marches for Chavez, and his name is on the Cultural Center and a school in San Luis and on separate boulevards in San Luis and Somerton. San Luis Mayor Nieves Reidel told KAWC she made the call to cancel a groundbreaking ceremony that was scheduled for Monday for the Cesar Chavez Boulevard Multimodal Improvements Project.
As a matter of fact, we were going to do the grand, the Cesar Chavez Boulevard start of the work. You know, we were going to do a ceremony on the 23rd.
Yes.
And I cancel that, and I cancel any celebration that it was programming, because this is the month of Cesar Chavez if I had any doubts after reading Dolores Huerta's statement, it's like I'm heartbroken because of what happened to her and all those girls, and I'm very disappointed. And it's unbelievable, huh? We Mexican-Americans do not have a lot of heroes that we can look up to. I think he was an iconic figure, and everything was a lie. Extremely disappointed, but hurt because of the pain that he caused to so many women and young ladies, young girls.
And of course also he died in San Luis, so he's a part of San Luis history as well. So
yeah, yes, he died here. He died in the Gila Valley, and I thought he was one of us. And he goes to prove to you that you really do not know people. We're canceling everything as we speak, and we're gonna have a meeting, and we're gonna decide what we're gonna do. As you know, we have the Cultural Center. We have his statue there. We have a street named after him. We have the boulevard. And he was part of the community. He was, like I said, one of us. But we need to understand the pain, the horrendous crime that are being investigated, although I don't think that it will be any criminal implications. He's dead.
Right.
We need to be, you know, conscientious of what went on.
Yes.
And I do believe these women, okay?
Stay tuned to KAWC for more on local reaction to Cesar Chavez news as we receive it. For KAWC, I'm Victor Calderon.
For Arizona Edition, I'm Cisco Stargazer. Castle Dome Middle School temporarily shut down its campus on March 11th through 13th for cooling system repairs. According to Yuma School District 1 Communications and Community Engagement Coordinator Christine McCoy, the decision was preventive.
The chiller at Castle Dome is not working at its full capacity, and with the temps getting unseasonably high, the classrooms were becoming too warm. The forecast shows another peak expected while repairs are underway, so we are implementing this alternative now rather than wait.
In the meanwhile, Castle Dome students were given the option to learn remotely or in person at a nearby elementary campus. Students who opted for in-person learned in large air-conditioned spaces like cafeterias or multi-purpose rooms at Desert Mesa, Mary A. Atondo, and Sunrise Elementary Schools. They completed coursework through a combination of online learning and teacher-supported activities. But normally, a school district wouldn't opt to conduct repairs in the middle of an active instruction period. Was it willful negligence? Well, no. Comments from Governing Board Member David Ibarra at the March meeting revealed that the matter boiled down to funding.
I wanted to see the air conditioning chillers and the water towers that have been at Castle Dome since 1998. I found that these units are beyond their shelf life. Throughout the years, purchase orders to replace this equipment has been submitted to the state to have this equipment replaced. These requests have been kicked back, and they told Mr. Tamayo that the repair projects are not approved.
This is a common experience for Arizona public schools. Cooling systems fall under school facilities funding, commonly referred to as capital funding. The state's current capital funding model, however, has a troubled history of inadequately providing for schools. In August 2025, a Maricopa County Superior Court judge determined the state is not providing for a general and uniform public school system, a requirement from the Arizona Constitution. That judge has now issued a final judgment this March, giving the state 8 months to fix its school funding system. Under the current one, a school might apply for a building renewal grant from the Arizona School Facilities Board to address facility needs. That grant program replaced an earlier formula that automatically allocated money for facility maintenance based on factors like building age and size. But facility needs across the state exceed available funding, making these grants competitive. District 1 officials say that gap can leave schools in situations like Castle Dome, closing a campus during the school year. District 1 Superintendent Dennis Ponder told KAWC, quote, "I think this is a perfect example that supports returning back to the building renewal formula. If the formula was still in place and if it were fully and properly funded, we could have been proactive in resolving the issue," end quote. Castle Dome's temporary closure also sheds light on how districts navigate the system today. In a November interview with KAWC, Ponder commented that maintenance deferrals happen because districts are juggling different needs, and because the grant system essentially requires failures before they might fund maintenance.
There's always maintenance deference that happens within the district. I mean, that's kind of how you get support from the state, is you have to show that a system failed. So an air conditioner, rather than the state coming in and going, these are getting towards the end of life, let's replace them before they fail, or these are, you know, halfway through their useful life, we need to make sure we're doing XYZ type of maintenance to extend their life. The program is designed for us to wait for our air conditioners to fail, then the classrooms are impacted, the students are impacted, but then we can apply for money to replace the cost of that. And so that's one of the things that we have to look at when we're balancing our budget too, is could we go and spend our capital budget and say, well, these are old-ish, so we're just going to go ahead and replace them? I mean, we could absolutely do that, but at what cost to other things that we could get done in the district?
Typically, District 1 will pursue state funds it's eligible for when possible. But sometimes maintenance can't wait.
If there are things that are going to impact the structure, the safety, the foundation of a building, then those are not things we look at for deference. We don't defer those items. We handle those how we need to. Sometimes that's through insurance claims. Sometimes that is SFB, School Facilities Board, or the state's funding. And sometimes that's our own funding. So I don't want it to sound like, well, we can't afford this new roof, so we're just going to roll with it, right? We look at a spectrum of what is kind of safe, necessary, priority, important right now. And then that's what we look at using our funding on. And then things that get deferred just aren't the top priority for the $4 to $5 million we have this year for capital needs. So, and that's an annual thing that you rebalance or you recalibrate each year as those needs come up. And sometimes we have needs that come up in the middle of the year, and then those get moved to the top of the list because they're a priority for a specific building or location.
The capital funding ruling may result in an improved system, one that won't require schools to pick between letting facility systems fail or eating the costs themselves. But for now, in the case of Castledome, Ponder said District 1 is doing what it can to secure the funding it's owed. He said, quote, "As it currently stands, the state still hasn't approved funding to fix the issue for which they are responsible. This delay displaced over 900 kids in our community and impacted many others. We are currently forging a path forward to resolve the issue permanently in hopes that the state will recognize their duty and take over the payment of the solution as we move forward." End quote. Castledome reopened on Monday, March 16th, and school has resumed as usual, now with a properly operating cooling system. For Arizona Edition, I'm Cisco Stargazer, and this reporting is supported by a grant from the Arizona Local News Foundation.
Funding for Arizona Edition comes from listeners just like you. Your continued support allows us to bring you insightful conversations about issues and events impacting our community. Thanks to you, we are able to highlight the people and voices of Yuma and La Paz counties and encourage civil conversations around water, agriculture, healthcare, education, and much more. Please continue to tune in to Arizona Edition, and thank you for helping us keep our community informed.
For Arizona Edition, I'm Alexandra Rangel. The Cocopah Indian Tribe's Environmental Protection Office successfully completed its first ecological restoration project, restoring 40 acres of land at the Cocopah North Reservation. Part of the project included a three-day workshop led by Fred Phillips of Fred Phillips Consulting. The workshop brought together more than 30 participants and volunteers who contributed to hands-on field work while learning planting and restoration techniques.
Kevin, you're on willows. I would just, between the wet and here, just be staggering them.
Okay.
You know, I'd do maybe a section, leave a 10-foot gap, do another, just use your imagination. Sure.
Phillips has specialized in large-scale restoration and ecological landscaping projects for over two decades. During that time, he has worked on numerous initiatives, including tribal projects in the Yuma wetlands along the Colorado River. When the Cocopah tribe selected him for this project, he worked closely with the tribe to design a plan aimed at improving both habitat conditions and the quality of water flowing into the Colorado River.
We're standing at Cocopah North, and the beautiful thing about this project is up to now, all of the city's Yuma effluent, like I think 70, 80% of it, just went straight to the river. Went from the treatment plant straight into the river. From the Cocopah's vision, now all of that water in perpetuity will now flow through a 40-acre wetland, beaver ponds, you know, to clean up that water, to create habitat, to create another beautiful recreation area like the Yumis wetlands for Cocopah. And the tribe, it just came from the tribe. It was their idea to move this forward, and that was about 4 years ago.
The restoration site lies just west of the tribe's golf resort along the Colorado River, with plans for the restored area to eventually connect to the west wetlands through pedestrian-accessible trails.
That's what I like about these. They stop when they catch something. So 150,000 yards of dirt that we excavated, about a half mile of channel, water structures, overlooks, and eventually, you know, when you come out here in 5 years, it's going to be similar to walking through the East Wetlands, the beautiful trails, the shade trees, the benches, you know, recreation type stuff.
CocoaPot EPO Director Jen Alsbach and her team participated in the restoration efforts.
The purpose of this restoration workshop is to gather people that are interested in this kind of work, interested in ecological restoration. And this is a perfect opportunity because now we have this big site. It's 41 acres that's now constructed and ready to be planted. So it's the perfect grounds to have everyone out here who has this interest and learn these different restoration techniques, how to harvest native plants and grasses and trees and take them to this site and get them into the ground, get this site established with all kinds of native plants.
You know, 2 feet down, and the important thing is to have the feet of the cottonwood in the moisture.
Volunteers from nonprofits outside of Yuma joined the effort, along with tribal members from other departments who wanted to help and learn more about their land. Like tribal member Santana Salazar, who also works in the CocoaPot Cultural Resources Department.
Learning about all the different plants, what we use them for, how to restore them.
Salazar says it was rewarding to see other tribal members volunteering their time to work on their land.
So it's good to see, you know, our family members out here, and you know, we're from the reservation and we're doing this together, like having our native people out here working and stuff. So we could tell all of our family and relatives, like, hey, you know, take care of this. You know, you don't know how much hard work it was for us to come out here and do this.
The group planted dozens of willows and other native species, hoping to increase biodiversity on the North CocoaPot Reservation.
But as long as we keep the river clean, taking care of our nature, you know, hopefully it'll just grow, keep growing.
Up next, a feature from our student podcast, Siendo Primero, which explores what it's like to be a first-generation student. Our two hosts, Sahei Barcenas and Melanie Ruiz Lopez, dive into the world of artificial intelligence.
Can you present yourself?
Hi, my name is Brian Lizarraga. I'm 33 years old. Currently, I'm studying at AWC to become an accounting major. I also work at the Transfer Center.
Is English your first language?
Technically speaking, no. English is not my first language. I originally spoke Spanish when I was a little kid. And then around 5 to 6 years old, I started watching Looney Tunes, Power Rangers, and I started picking up English from there.
Have you used AI to understand a task or homework that seems hard for you?
I use AI all the time to help me with difficult questions, coming up with study prompt. What I love to do is I'll go through my assignments, find specific questions that I'm having trouble with, and then I'll go ahead and create practice problems. Instead of using the problems that they give me directly, I'll change some of the parameters, I might change the situation so that I actually engage myself in active learning.
What's your first memory of using AI? Do you remember what you used it for?
I remember I started using AI sometime around 2020, 2021, around during COVID. There were a lot of just basic image generators. There's that famous image of Will Smith eating spaghetti that looks like he's just eating a bunch of like crazy noodles. And so, you know, I love my pets. I was making little videos or little photos, putting my cat riding a surfboard or my dog on a skateboard, you know, very simple, very fun little projects like that.
I know you were at the panel and you were answering questions. Why were you there? What was your objective?
Part of the whole AI process, I'm part of the AI fellowship. So essentially, we're having students and faculty kind of meet together, come up with ideas on how students are using it and how we can go ahead and integrate it into specifically AWC in the school setting. Personally, why I was there, you know, I understand that there's a lot of skepticism about AI, or there are certain, you know, questions that students are afraid of asking. And so personally, you know, I've been there. I've been nervous. I didn't want to speak up. I didn't want to answer a question. I want to be a voice to those people who can't speak for themselves.
Do you think AI helps more than it harms people? Like when a teacher gives you a bad grade because you used AI, but maybe the student didn't understand the task, so they had to use AI?
I think that's part of the conversation that we're having right now, especially when we were speaking over at the panel that we had. I think it's more important for faculty and students to understand the guidelines. The more obvious the guidelines are, I feel that students can follow them and adhere to them a little bit easier. I always encourage students to, you know, if they put themselves in a situation where they fail, they know what they need to work on. They know what they need to use. And using AI should really be used to help supplement those areas where you need to focus on studying or learning the subject.
Has AI saved you time to spend with your family or to rest? Or is it just another thing to learn?
So it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. You know, when it comes to my setting, it definitely has helped kind of streamline the process. But ultimately, it's so that I can just do more work. Especially here, I work at the transfer center. Just today, I was creating spreadsheets so that we can organize how deans specifically relate to some of the credit for certificates that we have. And by using AI, I can make it more efficient so that I can get jobs done quicker, so I can move on to the next task and just be more available to students. You know, transferring is sometimes a lot to consider. And the more free time I have, the more time I have to interact with students.
Thank you a lot.
From Siendo Primero, I'm Melanie Ruiz López.
That was a great interview. It is important to say for everyone hearing right now that you talked to Brian after the event, The AI Elephant in the Classroom, made on March 10th here at AWC.
Yes, it was a very interesting day. Many students and professors were there to talk about how AI is changing in our classes. And we'll be hearing some interviews made that day during this program.
That's great! And Brian had a lot of good points during the panel. I think it's amazing how he used AI to help him at the transfer center, so he can spend more time talking to students.
I agree. He's using technology to make his work better. It's not about doing less. It's about doing things faster to help others.
True! And I love the funny part about creating the videos about his pets. It shows that AI can also be for fun and creativity.
Definitely. It's a tool for everything. And speaking of fun, we went out to the campus to ask students about the silly things they do with AI.
Let's listen to the next Flash interview. This is a Flash interview. Can I have your names?
Hi, my name is Belen Valtierra and my major is nursing.
My name is Regina Figueroa and I'm majoring in Administration of Justice.
I have a question. What is the silliest thing you ever use AI for?
The silliest thing that I've personally asked AI was this right question. That was the silliest thing that I've asked AI. Because I normally use it for homework, but like, I think this is the silliest question. Also, like, one, I literally used it to ask at what time McDonald's finished serving breakfast. Yeah, I think those are like the ones.
Probably the silliest thing I asked AI to do was to make me characters, because I have like this active imagination. I like to make scenarios in my head and I'll be like, oh, AI, I'll make me a character that have this description or something so I can use it in my scenarios. Sometimes they come out pretty curious and not that nice, but it's something.
Thank you so much for your responses. From Siendo Primero, I'm Sahei Bárcenas.
Those answers were so funny. It's great to see that students at AWC are having fun with AI.
I agree. It's not always about doing homework. Sometimes we just want to laugh.
Exactly. But Sahei, I have a question for you. We just heard what people ask AI, but what is the silliest answer you have ever received?
Déjame te cuento. A few weeks ago, I was working on a project for my math class. I wanted to know what kind of house I can afford in the future with a graphic design salary.
Suena que es un proyecto difícil. Did you find a house you liked?
Yes, I put the price in the chat to know if I was doing right for the next formulas, and the AI literally told me, ooh, keep dreaming, sigue soñando. Take another one.
No way! That's so mean!
I know! I was like, give me some hope!
I really can't believe it. AI has no chill.
You just heard a piece from our student podcast, Siendo Primero. Hear the full episode on our website under podcasts. Arizona Edition is a production of KAWC Colorado River Public Media. Questions or comments are welcome. Send them to az@kawc.org. You can also connect with KAWC on Facebook and Instagram. Our theme music was used with permission and composed by Stephen Hennig and performed by members of the Yuma Jazz Company. More information at yumajazz.com. I'm Alexandra Rangel. This is KWC's Arizona Edition. Thanks for listening.